All right, friends, hi. Overcame the timing on the last little program. We are at 138, Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 138A. And we are dealing with the arms of the fixed cross. Just to review, this is the cross of the soul. And it conditions the man who is on the probationary path, the probationary disciple, and then an accepted or pledged disciple. And I've discussed the beginning of the fixed cross influence. It's outstandingly the cross of the soul. It's the cross of right direction, we've been told. It's the cross of fixed vision and immovable intent, which draws the man from points of light to blazing solar radiance. Magnificent statement. It's the cross whose four energies blend with and transmit the energies of the solar system itself, and we begin to think, will the cardinal cross transmit what we call cosmic energies? This is possible. Okay. Yes, so that is the question. Are there more cosmic energies which are accompanying the influence of the cardinal cross if solar systemic energies accompany the fixed cross? Of course, all these zodiacal constellations are, in a sense, cosmic. So they will all the crosses will transmit the zodiacal potencies, which are lords of constellations, or the energies coming from lords of constellations. And finally, this is the cross that continues to evoke response until the third initiation. Let's see. And I discussed that possibly this continues beyond that point, beyond the third initiation, and I've explained the reasons why I think so, but then it's not a pure form, because what is happening is that the energies of the monad are blending with the energies of the soul, and maybe some anticipation of the energies on the cardinal cross are coming in. But really, we have to overturn the cross at the fourth initiation, which is our own cross, in order to really mount the cardinal cross, which I think happens far more at the fifth degree than is possible at the fourth degree, and still more at the sixth degree. All right, we've caught up then a little bit, and the four arms of the cross are Taurus, Leo, Scorpio, and Aquarius. Blinding light, fiery pain, bitter woe, and liberation. It is called the fixed cross because man is stretched upon it by the directed choice and immovable intent of his soul. The man as a soul, the man as a soul in incarnation. It cannot be the solar angel which fixes us upon the cross, upon this cross. So from this decision, there is no turning back. Of course, fixity upon the fixed cross does include the first and second initiations, and we do know that for most there is no turning back, but for some there can be a veering off to the left even after these initiations are taken, which is a startling thought. But in general, no turning back. And by directed choice, it sounds like Libra is involved and Capricorn, and the immovable intent of the soul, Sagittarius, somewhat involved here, that the man is crucified upon this cross. It is by choice. directed choice and immovable intent of his soul. So there is definitely involved here a kind of pledge is involved. Once we are a first-degree initiate, we are certainly pledged. First-degree initiate, we are certainly pledged, because without a sufficient pledge, without sufficient intent, we would never have gotten to the first initiation at all. So we accept the rules, we try to fulfill them. Increasingly, we promise, we pledge, we become the first degree initiate, we remain the pledged disciple, we become the accepted disciple, many do, and continue their pledge. And even one can become, I think, a pledged initiate, as it is called. Let's take a look at that and see if I can... pledged initiate? Yes, there are several references to this. Resume your active position as a pledged initiate disciple, a position which your co-disciples have ever recognized as yours. And as I have shown you, definitely how valuable has been to you the last immediate experience, etc. And he went into that. The pledged initiate disciple, he's speaking to Roberto Assagioli here. Let's see what else. Until a man is a pledged initiate, he cannot comprehend the matter. So, that much information is withheld until the student is a disciple, and still more, until he is a pledged initiate. For this reason, the reason for this is found in the fact that all knowledge concerning energy, its application, and its misuse, concerns energy, its application, and its misuse. All right. So we cannot be trusted until we are. A pledged initiate, of course, can be as well an initiate of the first and second degree. Even when one is a true initiate, one continues one's pledge in a way, but one has confirmed that one means business. The path is the path of all. The path is of all the paths, the most veiled in the clouds of mystery. This has to do with the path to Sirius. The reason for this mystery will be apparent only to the pledged initiate, though a clue to the secret may be gained if it is realized that a peculiar and in a peculiar and esoteric sense, the sun Sirius and the Pleiades hold a close relation to each other. It seems like this term, the pledged initiate, can extend even beyond the third initiation. This is my impression, because we're talking here about unveiling the something about the path to Sirius, and since that path has only begun at this time, after the sixth degree, why this path should be veiled and shrouded in mystery could be, it's unlikely that it could be revealed to someone who is not yet a third degree. So there are pledged disciples and also pledged initiates. It seems that a kind of a pledge, ever ascending upward in its intensity, is found at excuse me, at all the different degrees. So anyway, the cross of directed choice and immovable intent, we might call it. The man is stretched upon it, and it is called the fixed cross because the man has, or is there because of the directed choice and immovable intent of his soul. And from that decision, there is no turning back. Okay. Now we move on to the cross of the risen Christ. We have the hidden Christ. We have the, in a sense, the crucified Christ. Let's see what we are calling it here, crucified Christ, yes, and finally, the risen Christ. In what manner is this rising to be understood? Following the fourth degree, there is a type of resurrection. It leads to the fifth degree. And from that time on, the man is resurrected in that sense, in that he is no longer confined by matter and necessarily finding his way back into the forms of the human kingdom. But there is another resurrection as well, and that is of the seventh degree, and surely by that time the man finds himself on the cardinal cross. This is the cross whereon, under the occult paradox and in time and space, the spirit is crucified. Okay, can the spirit really be crucified? It's not just the consciousness, it's the scope of being, the scope of being and of expressing energy is crucified. However, it lasts a very long time, and it is an occult paradox indeed, because the spirit in a way is all things, even that upon which it is apparently crucified. But there is, if time and space exists in relation to the cardinal cross, then time and space, in some form or another, do not immediately cease, even after relatively high initiations. So we could say that, Okay. That time and space do not cease even after relatively high initiations, because you can only be upon the cardinal cross minimally if you are a master, or, you know, gaining upon the cardinal cross after the fourth initiation. And it really relates to much higher lives altogether who are undergoing different kinds of series of cosmic initiations. So time and space are still operating. And we're told that our planetary Logos, who is an initiate of very high degree compared to the human being, has his own time-space schedule. So before we dispense with time, dispense with space in all the different categories of those two, let us be cautious, because in a sense, the universe itself is a unit of time, and it is certainly the appearance of space. So there are a number of different manners in which we can interpret these words, and we have to watch for the contexts. Its four energies govern and direct the soul as it moves forward upon the path of initiation. Now, this begins at the third degree, and yet it has been stated that at the fourth degree, the initiate is on neither cross. So let's just see if we might be able to perhaps find that quickly. Fourth initiation, cross, cardinal. Let us see. Right. The cross, okay. Cardinal cross, it is to this cross that the discipleship shifts at the fourth initiation from the fixed cross of the heavens. So here he tells us that the fixed cross at least continues until the fourth degree. Interesting, but there is a place where we are told also, and here it is, and this seems a contradiction, that the cardinal cross governs the master, yes, as he passes through the remaining five initiations, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The fourth initiation is, curiously enough, governed by neither the fixed cross nor the cardinal cross. The disciple is descending from the fixed cross and seeking to mount the cardinal cross. So here it is quite evident on page 694 of the Rays and the Initiations, a further clarification has been given. And we learn, apparently, in contradistinction to what we are reading here, that the Cardinal Cross does not begin its work at the third initiation, because the path of initiation does begin at the third degree. But maybe DK is talking in general about how the initiate moves forward in general upon the path of initiation. I think we're going to look at this and make it a point of reference. So this is Ray's Initiations 695, I believe. 694. And I will also make this just a little smaller. It seems the right thing to do. All right, there we go. Green and smaller. So the Cardinal Cross governs the master as he passes through the remaining five initiations, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The fourth initiation is, curiously enough, governed by neither the fixed cross nor the cardinal cross. And that I want to bring to our attention. I think it's very important. The disciple is descending from the fixed cross at that fourth initiation, presumably, and seeking to mount the cardinal cross. He descends from the fixed cross because it is at that point that the soul is fully developed, or at least that limitation of soul that expresses itself in the causal body. Soul consciousness can go no further if it is to be confined to the causal body. So we descend from the fixed cross at that point when the soul has reached its maximum point of development within the egoic lotus. But as I said before, the soul ray continues, interestingly enough. So the after the fourth degree, we really have a kind of a transition operating. The disciple is descending from the fixed cross and seeking to mount the cardinal cross, and it is this transition period and experience which practically govern him. Okay. So it might be therefore noted that there are three initiations which test the disciple as to knowledge and experience, the first, second, and third, and then comes the initiation of transition, followed by five initiations which the master undergoes on the cardinal cross. It couldn't be any clearer than that, although DK does say other things occasionally which seem to lead in a different direction, and we have to simply ponder that. So its four energies of the cardinal cross govern and direct the soul as it moves, bring that down a little bit, as it moves forward on the path of initiation. Now, let's go a little further here. Necessarily, as it deals with so exalted a state of consciousness, there is but little I can say anent this cross except the vaguest generalities. And let us see where we are here in Esoteric Astrology, approximately page, let's see if we're there. Okay. So first he has reviewed the ideas here, and we're going to deal with the cross of the risen Christ. All right. All right, so point number B here, letter B. It is therefore preeminently the cross of initiation and of beginnings. Let us say that all initiations are actually beginnings. We are entering into a new state of being and awareness. All initiations are beginnings. It concerns fundamentally the beginning of the endless way of revelation, and this we might call really the way of higher evolution. It begins, a master in the old days could make his decision and tread the way of higher evolution. Now this is usually reserved, I believe, until the sixth degree. The way of higher evolution, which starts when nirvana is entered, and for which all the previous stages of the path of evolution have been but preparatory. So when is nirvana entered? The atmic plane is called the nirvanic plane. And here we might say that nirvana begins. But in a still greater sense, it begins at the sixth degree. The Buddha, well, let's put it like this. If the Christ, became a sixth degree initiate at the during his last appearance, then surely the Buddha was a six-degree initiate before that. Six-degree initiate before that. That is clear, because the Buddha is always just a little bit ahead of the Christ in the initiatory status, even though now apparently they will complete the seventh initiation together. This is, as they did, interestingly, complete the fourth degree together in an Atlantean ashram. I don't know how usual it is for initiates to face the initiator together in pairs. In the case of the Christ and the Buddha, it happened once, we are told, and will happen again. All right, so where does nirvana really begin? Well, the nirvanic plane is the atmic plane, and the need to re-engage with the five lower levels, which are the Brahmic sub-levels of the cosmic physical plane, is ended for most after the sixth degree. They can be on their way. So in a way, that is nirvana. If we consider nirvana, the beginning of the endless way, then it is at this time in initiatory development, the sixth degree. All right. In the old days, a master could begin that type of work and could go on the long journey, and then nirvana would not be so much beginning at the sixth degree, but the fifth. But nevertheless, the Buddha had to have achieved nirvana. He was, I believe, and have stated, already an initiate of the fifth degree. If he was the head of the hierarchy at that time, handing that over to the Lord Maitreya 500 years before Lord Maitreya's appearance in Palestine. And so the Lord Maitreya would have had to have been also a fifth degree initiate from that time on. One cannot be the head of the hierarchy without being a fifth degree, and the Buddha had around him many arhats whom he was teaching. How do you teach the arhats if you are not at a higher degree than they are? Probably, to my way of thinking, he had been a fifth degree initiate and became a sixth degree initiate at his enlightenment, which was an altogether higher octave of enlightenment than the kind that we experience at the illumination, or what we would call the third degree. So the following quotation may carry understanding and help to illumine this most difficult subject, indicating the significance of this cardinal cross as a consummating influence. Now, you know, there are, and revealing that which lies ahead for those who attain hierarchical standing. Consummating influence, we have to ask this. Is the ninth degree a, quote, consummating influence? We are told that great cosmic lives are crucified on the cardinal cross. Probably a higher aspect of that cross altogether. So the ninth initiation does not reach to where these great cosmic lives are found. It's still an initiation of the fourth creative hierarchy. And as I've stated, there are different strata of cosmic initiations. Man may achieve his first cosmic initiation as man at the fifth degree. But the planetary logos has a different series of cosmic initiations during which he remains a planetary logos, and a solar logos has a different, still different series of cosmic initiations during which time he remains a solar logos. So let us see what the old commentary has to say here. All beauty, all goodness, all that makes for the eradication of sorrow and ignorance upon the earth must be devoted to the great consummation. Aha. Well, this is not the old commentary. It's a quotation, and it's a wonderful one, and it contains the sentence that I so often use. All beauty, all goodness, all that makes for the eradication of sorrow and ignorance upon the earth must be devoted to the great consummation. When the Lords of Compassion shall have spiritually civilized the earth and made of it a heaven, there shall be revealed to the pilgrim the endless path which reaches to the heart of the universe. Man, then no longer man, will transcend nature and impersonally, yet consciously, in at one-ment with all enlightened ones, help to fulfill the law of the higher evolution, of which nirvana is but the beginning. And we are also told, let's see, I think, nirvana... Nirvana and the Endless Way. Let us see here. There is another quotation. The beginning of the Endless Way. It concerns fundamentally the beginning of the Endless Way, and that's where we are right now. Let us see further if there's anything. Right. There arises in the consciousness of the disciple a vision of the Endless Way, of which nirvana is but the beginning. So we're coming to that section, and we've quoted the Evans-Wentz paragraph, which is very similar to this. And here we have in esoteric astrology, still later, what I'm hinting at in reality is really is the objective of that endless way in which nirvana itself is but the open door. This is expressed still differently, but we get the idea. Nirvana is not the end. It is surely but the beginning of what has been called the endless way. Is it endless? What about the Mahapralaya of the entire solar system? Is nirvana, is the way of higher evolution endless, or does it simply seem endless? Or when you think that universes are but moments of space in eternal duration, I like that. Does it mean anything? I don't know, but I'm going to write it. Universes are but moments of space in eternal duration. I like that. Seems like it has something to do with the union of the highest aspect of space and time. So when there are endless of these moments of space, endless universes, it is in a way an endless way. But if we call progress, high progress, an endless way, we should also call it a beginningless way. Don't you think? Because moments of space come and go. Universes come and go, and yet the way continues. The way is self-experience. The way is self-experience. It is the experience of the unlimited in limitation. The experience of the unlimited in limitation. Well, occasionally there's a little deviation into philosophic thought, because things are said which are statements sufficiently true. Sufficiently true to be as indicative as required. But when we reach nirvana, we've reached nirvana repeatedly upon the endless way in every cosmos that ever has been. Of course, this challenges the human mind. The human mind cannot fathom it. But there are such beautiful things said here regarding the great consummation. Well, it is the ninth degree as far as man is concerned. So is that the great consummation, or is the spiritualization of the earth and its becoming a sacred planet and the elevation of humanity considered the great consummation? And of course there would be many great consummations depending on the sphere of development that we are talking about, whether it's solar or constellational or greater. All beauty, all goodness, all that makes for the eradication of sorrow and ignorance upon the earth must be devoted to the great consummation, some, let's say, climax for the human being, for humanity, for the planet, and beyond. But the consummation for humanity and the human being would be sufficient for us at the moment, and there will be, of course, a consummation climax as well for the planet, for the planetary logos. Then when the Lords of Compassion, interesting, now there's the Masters of the Wisdom and the Lords of Compassion, but I think this is being understood in the sense that every Master of the Wisdom is really, because of his great compassion, also a Lord of Compassion, although there may be technical ray differences between them. Then when the Lords of Compassion shall have spiritually civilized the earth and made of it a heaven, heaven to earth, heaven to the earth under the seventh ray, there shall be revealed to the pilgrims, who are the monads, the endless path which reaches to the very heart of the universe. But if the universe ends, so does that path end, but still, for all figurative purposes, it is an endless path. If the Brahman chronology is correct and we still have 150 trillion years left to go in our tiny little solar system on all its different levels, then we might as well call this path endless. There shall be revealed to the pilgrims the endless path which reaches to the heart of the universe. Man, then, no longer man. He will have changed kingdoms, and he will have changed hierarchies. He will be a different being altogether. He will be an aspect of a group being, and yet that group being itself. Man, then, no longer man, will transcend nature, transcend form and matter, and impersonally, yet consciously, in at one-ment with all enlightened ones, in other words, the man will not identify himself with any particular form, which we usually call the person. So the sense of identity will go far beyond any particular instrument. That's the point. We have to disengage our sense of identity from our instrument. He will transcend nature, and impersonally yet consciously, in at one-ment with all the enlightened ones, there is a realization of that as one ascends, help to fulfill the law of the higher evolution. The higher evolution of which nirvana is but the beginning. So there is no need for distress or unhappiness or the sense of doom or futility. One just cannot keep the spirit from showing up, from reappearing. The spirit will always rise, and it will always escape from any form that seeks to confine it. And in this respect, death is an illusion. It's simply a change of consciousness for the spirit. All right. I do hope I remember this so I can ponder it. That universes are but moments of space, not moments in space, but moments of space in eternal duration. On more to the cardinal cross, it is the cross of the widespread arms, the open heart, and the higher mind. For those who lie upon this cross know and enjoy the significance underlying the words omnipresence and omniscience, and are in process of unfolding the higher phases of being which we inadequately cover by the word omnipotence. So here we are speaking, for those who lie upon this cross, we are speaking of masters and those of still higher state. Widespread arms, including vast aspects of the universe and maybe the entirety of the universe. Who knows how long this cross goes, but including vast expanses outwardly and inwardly of the universe. The open heart, because the unity is existing without question, undeniable, and the higher mind. Whose mind? Well, not just the triadal mind, but beginning to get into the cosmic mind. For those who lie upon this cross know and enjoy the significance underlying the words omnipresence, at least in relation to our planet, if one is a master, and omniscience in relation to the planetary sphere. Always there is a question. We can't even say that for sure, because Sanat Kumara is existing within the planetary sphere, and the planetary logos has the planetary scheme as its emanation, and even for the master upon the cardinal cross, there is not omniscience with respect to that great being, to the planetary logos, or even to Sanat Kumara, nor is there in a way omnipresence, except that it is sense, because the master is usually not allowed into Shambhala unless a master of a particular type. So these again are relative terms. It all depends what sphere we're talking about, omnipresence and omniscience. So let us define our sphere. We're certainly not yet, and for a while, speaking of the solar sphere, the great solar atom. We cannot be speaking of that, because even for the planetary logoi, some of them are just gaining the omniscience of the solar atom or the solar system, and I suppose they are in a position to understand their omnipresence, but whether it is a sensed omnipresence or a practical, effective and active omnipresence, that remains to be seen. In other words, are they actors everywhere in the solar system, or do they simply sense that they are potentially so and are in essence everywhere in the solar system? Going on a little more about the definitions of this type of cross, the cardinal cross. The energies of the cardinal cross blend with the energies to which we can give no greater name than cosmic energy, even though that word is meaningless. Well, it's as I thought. If the fixed cross blend with systemic energies, then the cardinal cross blends with what's called cosmic energy or energies. They carry the quality. The energies of the cardinal cross carry the quality of the one about whom naught may be said. And I've called this being in other terms, the super constellational logos. Well, I'm not going to super cosmic logos. Also super constellational logos, because in this being, constellations are as chakras. So somehow the energies of the cardinal cross can carry a quality of the one about whom not may be said. What is that quality? It seems to have a powerful, very powerful third ray, maybe the major third ray. It comes from that source. It has a strong second ray. Does it have a first ray, per se? Some theorists have thought that it does, but certainly it carries cosmic buddhi and mahat, or cosmic manas. And they are tinctured with the light of the seven solar systems, of which ours is one. Well, this is one of those statements, much blinded, but as I've said, the seven solar systems are actually, I believe, solar systems, and are not constellations. So it carries the quality of the one about whom naught may be said, with all of his centers, and the light of the seven solar systems, of which ours is one, are also delivered through the cardinal cross. As we examine this carefully, there, and I, I have argued this with myself before. There is a sense in which the word solar systems is a blind. It can mean simple solar systems of one or two stars. The two very closely related to each other, so they would be, in a sense, binary stars. But ours is a single star solar system, and it is a solar system, and when we look at others, we cannot tell always whether they have other stars associated with them, but often we can, and there are many single-starred systems, even if they have no planets. But it's also possible that the term solar systems can simply mean this. And another possibility that solar systems can mean stellar systems or systems of stars, which are constellations. So when it comes to the idea of the seven solar systems of which ours is one, yes, there is, I think, a group of local stars of which our single star, Sol Helios, is one. But there may also be, and this is where the blinding comes in, there may also be a series of seven stellar systems of which our local stellar system, including, including our sun, there may also be a series of seven stellar systems, or these would be constellations, really, of which our local stellar system, including our sun, is one. So it all depends on what we mean by solar systems. If we mean systems of stars, they are stellar systems. If we mean an aggregation in which there is one star, and maybe yes, maybe no, a number of planets, we can also call it a solar system. So if the cardinal cross is carrying the quality of the one about whom naught may be said, in whom various constellations, including our local constellation, of which our sun is a part, if it carries the energies of that great being, it may also carry the energies of these stellar systems, which we might, in a blinding way, call solar systems, or systems of stars. It might also, the cardinal cross, might also carry the energies of those local stars of which our sun is one local star. Procyon, Sirius, Alpha, Beta, Centauri, Epsilon, Eridani, that's been proposed, Fomalo, Vega, Altair, all of those have been proposed. Fairly local stars of which our sun is one, and that entire stellar system or constellation revolving necessarily around the Pleiades, if the whole story of revolution around the Pleiades is accurate and not simply symbolic. We are told that such an evolution or revolution takes 250,000 years approximately, so it sounds like it is an actual astronomical fact, but so many of those who are applying physics to astronomy say it cannot be so, and they have their own reasons related to the distance and the mass of the Pleiades and the mass of our solar system, and I suppose the others. although they do not countenance, they do not contemplate that the others, local with our sun, would also revolve around the Pleiades as a center. The further you go, the less you know. There is so much we just don't know. But we have to make ourselves teachable, which takes a little while. And it means we have to finally admit we know just about nothing, so we can truly be open to what can be poured in, impressed upon us. The scope and cycle of its influence in the life of the initiate is utterly unknown, even to our planetary logos, who is himself stretched upon its widespread arms, including, of course, many cosmic beings. So we have established that while man may be on the cardinal cross until the ninth initiation, there are other beings on that cross who were, as man is now, even many Mahamanvantaras ago. So we can tell somewhat when the cardinal cross begins, pretty much at mastership, but we certainly can't tell where it ends. And even our planetary logos, who is hugely more advanced in consciousness and in power and in love than we are, cannot tell either. So maybe the solar logoi themselves are in a way stretched upon the cardinal cross. But you see, there has to be a higher analog to the cardinal cross, because if we start talking about great cosmic beings being on the cardinal cross, some of them, many, most, are outside the influence of our particular zodiac altogether. So those particular constellations, Cancer, Aries, Cancer, Libra, Capricorn, would not be influential in such lives, because their lives would be altogether beyond the reach of these constellations, which might appear to be lesser constellations to those vast perspectives. So when does the cardinal cross related to our zodiac end? There might be other cardinal crosses, other threefold divisions, but let's just say, when does the cardinal cross related to our zodiac, related to our zodiac, actually end? I don't think we have to worry about that so much, because we're far, very far from being planetary logoi, and if even he doesn't see where it ends, and he might be able to see where it ends if it ended after the solar logos. So there are solar logoi who are within that ring pass nod of our zodiac, the heart and the head center of the great super cosmic logos, super constellational logos. So the influence of that zodiac will operate for a long time on local stars and on local aggregations of stars, local starry systems who are inferior to the constellations of the zodiac. So for a very, very long time, the zodiac of constellations will be operating. And then we can still speak of the cardinal cross as it relates to our zodiac. The question would be, could we speak of a cardinal cross, which did not relate to our zodiac? And I suppose theoretically we can imagine that we could, but for the time being, the cardinal cross as we presently define it has four signs, four constellations: Aries, Cancer, Libra, and Capricorn. Well, now what we're going to do is we're going to enter another phase where, rather than simply summarize the nature of these crosses, DK is going to describe them in greater detail. If we're ever going to be able to create the charts of the crosses, we have to know a great deal about what the crosses are as structures and not just the signs that are on the crosses. Astrologers often tend to think in terms of individual signs, or they might think generally in terms of triplicities or quadruplicities, but usually as these groupings affect the human being, and not for what they are really in a cosmic sense. This new astrology is giving us a much greater view, though still tiny, I suppose, a much greater view of the place and meaning of various stellar beings and constellational beings in our local cosmos. Of course, astrology could be considered universal. What are the relationships between the galaxies as according to their own logoically designed mathematics coming from the universal logos as they move in relation to each other, and probably cyclically at that? All of that would be a branch of astrology that would be practiced by whom? You can imagine certain students of universal astrology being numbered among the solar logoi. Not all would study it necessarily, but some would, and they would be speculating upon the effects of the constellations upon them and of galaxies upon constellations and of galaxies upon each other and so forth. Just as we are speculating about great beings, if a solar logos decided to be a student of astrology and to deal with the galaxy, he might be dealing with an aggregation of 250 billion solar logoi. It would be a worthy and difficult area of astrology. So it continues. Astrology, the greatest and the oldest of all the sciences, will have a definitely cosmic and even universal application. Meanwhile, we have to be quite satisfied with what we have here. We have a little planet, big for us. We have a solar logos, non-sacred, extremely sacred for us. We have a solar logos of immense love, holding the position of a heart center within a cosmic logos. How long will it be before we, any initiation we take can be in a way supported or attended by or administered by a solar logos? Time just disappears in the vastness. And if we can have a conception of life which is sufficiently vast, we will go a long way towards eliminating the illusion of time. And yet, the universe itself is a moment. And how did I try to say that earlier? Universes are but moments of space in eternal duration. Or could I have said, are but spaces of time? Maybe that. That sounds easier to understand, but I still want to ponder moments of space in eternal duration. Somehow the illusion of time as we conceive it has to snap, and we have no longer to sense the limitation of our life. I mean, practically we have to, because we are obliged to work within a limited sphere. That's all part of the law and part of what the absoluteness does. But in terms of our higher consciousness, need we feel limited, although we work through limited instruments and limited contexts, need we feel that our identity is in any way limited? And there I would say, I don't think we do. But it takes a lot of self-training to arrive at that point. Well, anyway, we're going to deal shortly with the cross of the hidden Christ. And for this moment, we'll bring this to an end, which is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 138A. And I'd like to make that red, as I have been all of them. And we're on page, I suppose, 557, and beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 138B, and page 557. So now we'll go into greater detail, and we'll see some symbols for these crosses, and we'll try to fathom something of the symbols. They're beyond us in many ways, but at least we will see that far greater minds than our own have been working to encapsulate the essence of the meaning of these great relationships that we call structures. Really, if you think about it, a cross is a relationship between lives. A cross is a relationship between lives. A specified type, a cross, is a relationship between great lives. All right, well, I would go on and on, which I cannot do, and so we'll see you in just a little bit, carrying on with Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 138B. Until then.